Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, I'm speaking with Victor Wooten. He has quite a few solo releases out, although he's best known as the bassist and one of the founding and current members of Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. He's also an author. Victor, we're going to be speaking primarily about your latest, The Spirit of Music, though easily weaving in and out between this and your first book called The Music Lesson.
Sure.
And if anybody wonders, really, if this is a follow-up to The Music Lesson, right at the title page we have The Spirit of Music, The Lesson Continues. So that was answered.
Yeah.
But before really addressing The Spirit of Music, can you please talk about coming to write The Music Lesson? I know you didn't want to write a formal theory book, and people were saying you should write a book, and then this happened.
Yeah, exactly. The instruction type book was not what I was willing to write. Because I knew that at the time, what I wanted to say was going to be quite different. And a lot of it may not even seem like I was talking about music.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, when you're playing music, it shouldn't sound like you're talking about music.
Mm.
So I didn't want to write a book that sounded just like music. It should be about life, which is what music should be about. And so I stayed away from writing for years until it dawned on me to not write an instruction book, but write a story, but put the lessons inside the story. And that's what movies do. Art does it. Any kind of art does that, whether it's a painting. There'll be stories behind the stories.
Yes.
But music is definitely about life, and our favorite songs tell the best stories. And so I figured I'd put the song aside and just tell the story.
That's really, really cool, and that's something that is going to, in a way, keep coming up, because I'm looking at both a synopsis, but in a way, the synopsis doesn't matter because it's really what's happening along the way, but we'll address that in a bit. I wonder if you could speak about, well, not just the dream you had, which is described in The Music Lesson, but can we briefly, I suppose, hear about the 10 elements of music, since that lays out the 10 chapters or measures of
sure.
The Music Lesson?
Sure, yeah. I just thought it would be kind of cool and clever to call them measures instead of having them be called the normal chapters. But I also, in The Music Lesson, I wanted to allude to the fact that each measure of the book, the chapter, was centered around a measure of music. The same way you put all the chapters together, you get a story. A lot of people miss the fact that if you put all those measures that are at the beginning of each chapter, there's an actual handwritten
yes.
measure of music. If you put them all together, you get a song. And so many people miss that. But the idea came about based off of a class that I had been teaching for quite a few years, especially once I started my music camps in 2000. The first class that I always teach deals with those 10 elements of music. And this came from my years of realizing, well, first, when Bela Fleck and the Flecktones started becoming popular,
yes.
it meant I was becoming popular, too, for bass players. I was showing up in magazines a lot, and then I started getting asked to teach a lot. And I had never taught anything, didn't really know how to teach. But I knew how I had been taught, and I had been taught in the same way we were all taught English, or our first language. And really, the truth of the matter is that we weren't taught. You know, not in the same way of what we think a teacher does. Nobody sat us down and told us what to learn first and gave us exercises and stuck us in a room and made us practice and then gave us homework. No one ever did that when we were learning to talk. So when it came for me to teach music, that was the only method I knew. Let's just do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking at what teachers were teaching and how teachers were teaching. And even though they were teaching good things, I thought the method was way off. If our goal is to make someone play naturally, the same way we speak naturally, if that's the case, the normal process does not work. Well, I shouldn't say that. It does work. It just takes way
sure.
too long.
Right.
Like decades. You know, and if it took decades to learn to talk, we would know there's a problem. But in music, we think it's normal. Actually, it is normal. It's a normal process, but I don't think it's the best one. I just think it's too slow. So I started looking at the fact that just about everyone was teaching mostly notes. What we call music theory, I'm going to say, is 90% notes, which and there's only 12.
12, yeah.
Right? So I realized that, you know, the stuff that people are teaching about notes is really good. I can't do anything better than that. So let me teach the stuff that's not notes.
Hmm.
Because literally, the notes you can buy, when you buy your instruments, the notes come with it. But everyone sounds different. I can name 100 bass players that I like, and they all sound different. But they're all using the same notes. So the reason that we sound different must not be the notes. So I started looking at what is making us different. And that's where I came up with the 9 other parts of music. So notes are important. We need notes for music. But I came up with 9 other things that I thought were just as important. And I just really set my sights out on focusing on those with the purpose of evening out the scale. And I don't mean like a musical scale. I mean like a weight scale where we put notes as holding the most weight.
Sure.
But nobody dances to notes. No, I've never heard of anyone say, hey, what key is this? This is E-flat? Oh, man, I got to dance. I've never heard of anyone saying that. We dance to rhythm. We dance to emotion, feel. So when I looked at if I took the notes away, what's left? There were a lot of things, but I came up with my 10 favorite. And then basically, because I had been teaching about these 10 elements through analogies and stories, writing the book using analogies and stories was very easy.
Nice.
The most difficult part, which really in the first book wasn't that difficult. It took a little more challenge in the second book, but the first book was kind of easy. But all I had to do was make a chronological story.
Sure.
That had a beginning, middle, and end that made sense, as well as made you want to keep reading from chapter to chapter.
Nice.
But what I wanted to say was pretty much complete because I had been saying it for years. But in writing it, you find a different part of yourself. You use a different part of your brain, which unleashes different and more knowledge. And so I wrote a lot of things in there that I had never thought about because the characters and the story starts telling itself, and I just write it down. But that's where the first book came along. And even when I finished the first book, I knew that there was more to say.
Sure.
But a book should only be so long. And, you know, I figured I hopefully if I lived long enough, I'd find time to see it.
Nice. I'll point out that there was something very problematic with me reading this. Not a bad thing at all. The only problem was I kept on wanting to stop and take notes.
Yeah.
I couldn't. But the reason for it, and maybe the reason I got away from it, is that I stopped taking notes about specific instances because this is very much a conceptual book. I mean, both of these books really are not at all how-to type of things or even beautifully crafted theory and fun ways to practice. It is a story, as we mentioned, divided in measures instead of chapters. But I really think the selling point of The Spirit of Music is not so much the plot line, but rather the notions, if not the slap-you-in-the-face profound introspective realizations which your character and hopefully the reader pick up. There is a fun adventure to the story, but it is really more about what's happening along the way. It's like those spaces between the notes.
Yeah, exactly. My short one-sentence line about each story is maybe the first book will give you some how to play and making everybody feel available. Like music is available, even to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the second book is more of why to play.
Yes.
And seeing that music needs our help. And now it's just so ironic that we're all in a pandemic and we can't go hear live music. So we're all really feeling it, which I think works in my favor with the new book saying the same thing. I hadn't planned that and I wouldn't plan it again.
Oh, my God, no.
Yeah. But this one, yeah, it's more why to play. And, yeah, I know a lot of people who have written notes. But I think the books produce a feeling inside you, I hope.
Yes.
That you carry around and you may or may not feel the need to write it down, but the overall sense stays with you, I hope.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I stopped even writing some of the specifics. That said, how about a brief synopsis? I mean, it is kind of a good, that is, you and your friends versus evil. We're talking about the phasers here. It's an adventure trying to save music. When we say the spirit of music, we're not talking about, hey, there's a feeling like the spirit of friendship or togetherness. This is the spirit, like this is a being, and we are trying to save it from dying. I may have just given the synopsis.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that was a concept I started in the music lesson, you know, bringing up the notion that music is or can be, and I would go far as to say is, an actual being. And I get into it a little bit more in this book, you know, and saying, you know, you don't have to think of it like a human or an animal, but think of it more like a spirit, you know, and then people can maybe digest what I'm talking about. But a lot of the times in our life, because we live in a physical world called Earth, we don't think things are real that we can't touch or see. And so we have a hard time with invisible things like, you know, a spirit or a ghost or whatever. But, you know, the wind, we can't see.
Yeah.
We can't see the wind, but it's alive. You know, it moves, it blows things. We can only see what the wind touches. And music is the same way. Music touches us, and then we move. But even you, me, and anyone else can hear music in our heads that no one else can hear.
Wow.
So music exists. Music exists already. But like two parents that are needed to produce a child that I believe existed somewhere also. Because as soon as that child is born, at least the parents see the personality right there. Music is the same. It also takes two to produce the third, for music to become physical. And this is also within the spirit of music.
Right.
For music to become physical, there needs to be an entity like a human or a bird or something, some being, and an instrument, right?
Yeah.
So if it's just the being, I can think of music. I can hear it in my head, but it's not physical yet. It's not a vibration we can measure or hear. Or there's an instrument. I'm looking at a bunch of instruments right now where I sit. And if I listen closely, they don't make a sound. So the instrument itself doesn't do it. The being itself doesn't do it. We have to come together. Even if the instrument is a voice, we have to come together. Once we come together in the right way, music is born. And because this is Earth, that's the whole purpose, is to be born. To live. So music wants to exist in the physical, but it takes us to make it happen. And what's happening right now is that we're losing touch, and music is trying to let us know.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. The entirety of this edition of KVC Arts is in conversation with Victor Wooten, part of the jazz fusion group Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, though he has quite a few releases under his own name as well. We are speaking mainly about his books, though, The Music Lesson, and the one just out, The Spirit of Music. Let's talk about music, which, by the way, in these books, music, it's always capitalized. And so that really lends itself to looking at it and just simply accepting it as a being with a proper name because it's capitalized. And so that's really cool. It's a nice effect. Within this dream, this is going briefly back to the music lesson, but it leads directly into the spirit of music. Talk about that dream of music and its danger.
Yeah. Well, I put it in the first book as a dream just to... release me from having to own up to it.
Okay.
I mean, really, that's why I wrote these fiction books. You know, I don't have to prove anything. I don't have to defend anything. I can say, no, I didn't say it. This character said it, you know. But the more I really learn to play music in a real way, and I know every musician has experienced it at some point, it's not like you're playing it. It's almost, to be cliche, like music is playing you. And at the least, you're joining with music and playing together. But it's a whole lot easier because I'm not trying to do 100% of it. Right. When I really became aware of playing like that, as a child, you do it anyway. When a child, before they learn to play, before they're taught, they'll just get on a piano. They'll just pick up a guitar. They'll pick up a stick or a drumstick and just play. You know, the same way kids will just play, period. They'll invent an imaginary friend or whatever. So when I realized I could play that way, joining with music, I wanted to take it further. I also started realizing that music is a language, does the same thing as a verbal language. Then I started saying, well, if music is a language, can I speak to music? Not just with music, but to music. It's the same way people might look at a religion. People talk about God all the time. Some people talk about how to use that force we call God or spirit or the universe. But some people have gone further and say, can I talk to this entity? And basically the answer for me was yes. But more so than talking, it was listening that really improved my awareness. Whether it improved my playing or not is, I guess, up to the public. But to me, I mean, it's the difference of like just talking to your mom or actually listening to your mom.
Mm.
You know, when you start to listen, that's where the wisdom is. Oh, I thought I had it all. Oh, no. You know, music's been around a lot longer than I have.
Yep.
So why wouldn't I listen? And when I started really listening and then deepening and solidifying and opening that channel, it became like miraculous. And so these are things I only talk about to close friends or family members. And so to write about it in the public, man, I better call it a dream or something.
Yeah.
And so that was why I did it that way. And these books, you know, we can call them fiction, but there's more truth in them in my mind than there are fiction. I always say the lessons are real, but the story may be fiction.
That's really a great way of putting that and really addressing something that I will admit that only slightly hesitantly, knowing that it's really, this is going to be good for laugh at my expense, and this will go out over the air. But I didn't realize at first that this book was fiction.
Yeah.
I got the PDF of The Spirit of Music first. Then I got a hard copy of The Music Lesson, and then eventually a hard copy of The Spirit of Music. So I was kind of went back and forth a bit. But yeah, so I took notes and I was reading and writing and thinking, and then I realized it was fiction. And I wondered how I missed this. Now, of course, certainly when you go into it and find out about people fighting the phasers and it becomes this Gilgamesh kind of thing. So then I went back, okay, I sort of stopped and rethought everything, and I even started a close examination of the covers and the quotes on the back and in the inset and all that. And one of these books, only one of the two, I forget which one, has, quote, this is a work of fiction, and this is in very, very small print on the page with the publishing information. And nowhere else does it say fiction. So
yeah.
I'm curious, was this intentional sort of, you know, between you and the publisher, an idea, this concept to just not let people know and just let them discover it or feel it in whatever way they want?
I don't remember actually talking to the publisher about it, because the original first book,
right,
The Music Lesson, I actually published myself.
Okay.
I put it out through my website, and then a gentleman who worked for Penguin around 2006 or so found it and brought it to them, the larger publisher, and they put it out, but they didn't change it.
Okay.
So how they worded it, whether it was fiction or not, was fine. And for me personally, I don't really care. I'd rather it be viewed as fiction. It's
okay.
Truth and or fiction. It's totally up to you. It's just what you want to agree to. So in other words, if I say, hey, man, this really happened, and if you're my close friend and you believe me, you would choose to say, oh, this is true. And then I would say, no, David, I was just kidding. Then you choose it wasn't. So even if it totally happened, you weren't there.
Wow.
So for you, it's just a story. So read it as a story. In other words, we go watch Star Wars or Batman or whatever. The lessons are real. There's a lot to be learned from these stories and these morals. And may the force be with you. Just change the word force to whatever you want, and you see the reality of that powerful phrase. We don't have to argue over who Yoda is. Was he real? Is Luke really Darth's son? You know, yeah. We don't have to go through that. Just learn from it. And I wanted a story that was approached the same way, where it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. Are you getting something from it? The lessons, again, are real, even though the story may not be.
This is almost a description of Michael, but we will return to him in a little bit. Oh, boy, is it a description of Michael, of what you just said.
Yeah.
But, you know, as for these books and the adventure, you know, even if a person misses the not-so-subtle allegory within, it still is a story to be enjoyed as an adventure, because it's not an epic tale of the Lord of the Rings, or I mentioned Gilgamesh or the Odyssey, something like that. In other words, events that are far, far removed from our time and physical place. Here we have a guy living in Nashville, driving around, bemoaning the fact that they can't just call Mike Stern or Herbie Hancock just to say, let's jam. You know,
yeah.
It's real. It's normal. So that, I think, makes it very, very relatable.
Well, I wanted it to be, David. I wanted it to be any person's real life. I wanted people to feel it. And because of that, I put in some things that weren't really me.
Right.
I mean, a lot of it is. I don't enjoy practicing. I like playing. But a lot of the things that Michael says in the book, I believe them. But I had to put in resistance because I knew that a lot of people would resist. And I want people to resist because Michael wants you to resist. He doesn't want you to just believe what he says. He wants you to question him. He wants you to think about it. And I wanted the reader to do the same. So I couldn't just put in there that I agreed with everything. you know, the narrator agrees, the narrator needed to push back in the same way I wanted the reader to question and push back. Because as Michael says, questions will keep things moving, will prolong the experience, the journey. Well, in many cases, an answer ends it.
And I believe Michael also talks about this as far as questions. This is almost this, not quite this true Socratic approach kind of thing, but I believe Michael says that if you have the question, you're 75% of the way toward the answer, something to that effect. And that is a really
Absolutely.
Cool way of looking at that.
And it's the truth. It's the truth. Any parent knows that. Your kids will tell you what they're ready to learn,
nice.
Whether it's about drugs or sex or whatever. And even if the question is not verbal, you can see the question by the activities that your kids will start either seeing, reading, or watching, or whatever. But yeah, once you have a question, you're within arm's reach of the answer. You really are.
These books, and mainly we are addressing the newest one, The Spirit of Music, but there is so much, I would say, continuous interplay between the two here. But what I want to address is that really, I think that The Spirit of Music, a lot of this, beyond the overall theme and adventure, it's about being a student and then eventually becoming a teacher. And there's that in the music lesson as well, so I have to say that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a saying, and I don't know which book this was in, but the saying is, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. But in your book, you have, when you're ready to teach, the student will appear.
Yeah, yeah. That is definitely one. It also says in The Spirit of Music that the teacher is always present. But when the student is ready, the student will recognize the teacher, right? The things you need to learn are always present. Life is like a genie in a bottle, you know? And in the Christian Bible, it says, before you even ask, I have answered, right? So life knows already and has always given us answers and knows more what we need more than we do. So it's two things. It's recognizing the student, but the teacher needs the student also.
Right.
And a teacher, the thing is that we always have students. We're always an example for someone, good or bad. So where the normal saying is when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Mm.
The Spirit of Music is saying when the teacher is ready, the student will appear. And that's sort of what happens at the end of the music lesson and at the beginning of The Spirit of Music. The narrator, which is my character, is reluctant to share or to teach, and music's calling on him, but he's trying to ignore everything. But for some reason, the student appears. And as the book says also, I can't remember if both books say this, but I do know The Spirit of Music says it, is that teaching completes the circle of knowledge. Meaning once you know something, you need to get good enough at it to teach it, because teaching it means you have to know it even more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Even more.
You mentioned that when you wrote The Music Lesson, you still had more to say, or you realized then that you still had more to say. So there were quite a few years between the books, and so I suppose I want to not so much say, okay, so what's your process, man? And by the way, I'm a huge jazz geek as well, and I'm so used to just addressing song by song and saying at 2 minutes you did this instead of this, and at the coda there was, yada yada. So this is interesting that to talk about concepts of words instead of that. But anyway, so when you were between these, let's say, years, or as you were getting ready for The Spirit of Music, was this just every month or so, just you were writing things down, finding time to write? Maybe, I don't know if you'd keep a diary or a journal or anything where you're remembering these things, and then they end up becoming fictional elements within a book.
Right. Well, a little all of the above. I don't totally keep a diary, but if you were to go through the notes on my phone nowadays, it could look like a diary. But nowadays, because our phones do everything,
oh yeah,
I keep notes in there, and I can title the notes. And I knew years ago that the next book I was planning, at least on calling The Spirit of Music.
Okay.
So I have notes in my phone titled, TSM, and different titles of, TSM ideas, TSM, book ideas, notes. I also run a camp called The Spirit of Music, so there's the camp notes. Exercises we can do, a scene might pop into my head where Michael says this or the student says this, and I would literally write a scene in my phone. But the music lesson, the first book, came out in 2008, meaning in mainstream. I released it maybe a couple of years before that on my website.
Gotcha.
But the mainstream came out in 2008. I actually released an album that same day, my album, Palm Mystery. The song that's written, Measure for Measure, in the book has the complete song on that record, and it came out the same day. And I did all that on purpose, too. But again, I knew I had more to say, because when you write a song, after you write it, you're better, which makes you want to write another song. You know, you're not done after one song. And that song teaches you what to do in the next song. So I learned so much about music and life in writing the first book. I knew there was more to say. So in 2011, I started writing. And I wrote quite a bit, but it wasn't flowing. The first book poured out in, you know, to be generous, I might say 2 months. The whole thing was written. But then you have to refine it to make it legible, you know, and where periods, verses, semicolons should go and all that kind of stuff, right. Which I knew nothing about.
Yeah.
So because it wasn't flowing in 2011, I put it down. I said, you know, I'm not under contract to do another book. There's no time limit. There's no deadline. Let's just wait. I started writing again in 2017. And I thought, because it wasn't flowing in 2011, I thought that what I had written wouldn't be that good, but I loved it. I was like, no, I don't have to start all over. And I had written about 11 chapters. I did rework them and finished it. I had to figure out what the ending was going to be. And I was maybe 2 chapters from the ending before I even knew how it was going to end, The Spirit of Music. The main thing I told myself was, don't force it. There's no need to force it. There's no deadline on this. And that's how it happened.
It's Conversation with Victor Wooten for the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts. We are speaking not so much about music as we are his books, The Music Lesson, and the very recent The Spirit of Music. I'm David Fleming. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 FM, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. You know, I think that another reason that it flows so well is because it's a first-person narrative. It talks about, so when I woke up, I did this. And when you say, I did such and such, that means that the reader can instantly, well, they're reading and therefore conceptualizing, I, that is me, I did this. And so it suddenly becomes them. And now the end of the first book has you telling, I'm not giving away, this isn't like a big plot killer here, but the end of the first book has you telling your new student, call me Victor. And when talking about the spirit of music, you refer to your character or the character of you. So sometimes I may be saying, okay, so when you did this, but I'm sorry, I really mean the guy in the book, but.
Well, you know, yeah. I do that.
Okay, good.
David, don't forget what you're going to say, but I got to say this.
Sure.
I wrote the whole first book thinking that the reader was going to be surprised at the end of the book, first book. When the student said, well, what should I call you? And I say, Victor. I thought that was going to be this, oh, man,
the big
I didn't
reveal.
Realize that was him. And everyone I gave the book to, and before it came out, everyone was reading it as me anyway.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I'm the only one that was fooled. <You know>? They already knew. So in this book, I didn't try to hide it. The second book, everyone knows it, thinks it's me anyway. So, you know, So we use my name quite a bit.
Yeah. It would be so easy. And again, I didn't realize at first it was fiction, because part of it, I was just picking it up and finding a random page. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And oh, here it is. I'm in Nashville. I'm going over to Virginia to see my parents. There's things that could and easily be Victor Lamont Wooten. But that said, how about hearing a few real instances in your life that became fictionalized accounts in the pages? One really nice one I know of. Maybe Gus, the recording engineer, playing Joni Mitchell and the woman with the shawl.
Yeah. Well, a sax player that I play with a lot, Bob Franceschini.
Yes.
I was doing an online book presentation just maybe a week ago. The saxophone player is married to my manager. And so he came on and told his story of the woman with the shawl. Basically, it was when I took him to visit Gus for the first time. And Gus played Joni Mitchell with the London Philharmonic and Wayne Shorter. And I just sat behind Bob and watched him try to nonchalantly and secretively wipe the tears from his eyes. And we just let him know, this is where everybody cries, right here. But this one woman, and I think I can say her name because she probably loved the publicity The woman that I was thinking about in this book, she goes by the name Jamie Shadowlight.
Okay.
And people can find her on Instagram or Facebook. She's a wonderful violinist, multi-instrumentalist, and plays guitar. And she lives out in California somewhere. But she happened to be at a show of mine in Colorado. And that was where we first met. And anybody that I meet that's kind of serious about music, I try to take them to see Gus. Because I know, it's not a guess, I know they're going to have the same experience I have when I first went there, when my friend took me to see Gus. And I'm sitting there, and what it hits, we're not crying, not only because it's that beautiful, we're crying also because we forgot. And there's a little sadness to it. I forgot this is the way it's supposed to sound. Speaking personally now, I'm a celebrated musician. Right? When people read my bio, they talk about all these wonderful things I've done, awards I've won, and they build me up. And then I'm sitting in that chair realizing even I forgot this is what music's supposed to sound like. And more so, what it's supposed to feel like. I mean, physically feel the music. Right? And this woman, Jamie, she just, whatever was covering her bare arms, she just removed it and put her arms out. So that the music could just flow across her arms, not just our ear. You know, it's like a breeze or a current of water, or when you feel the electricity in the air, maybe more like that.
Yep.
And I sat there and watched her with tears in her eyes. I sat there and watched Bob and a few other people that I've been able to introduce to Gus. It's remarkable. But it would be hard to find a story in, especially the music lesson, it would be hard to find a story in that book that wasn't based off of a real story.
Sure.
Now, I change it. I enhance it. You know, I don't use any last names because I don't want to call anyone out. You know, I don't usually give Michael's last name. You can find it. Look on my record. You'll find them. You know?
Okay.
Gus's last name I don't give out. But when I'm talking to people, I'll tell you who Gus is. In the first book, The Music Lesson, everybody but one character was based off of, or I should say inspired by a real person. And it's the same in the second book. People are inspired by real people. And I found out that if I based my fictional book off of reality, at least my reality, which plays like fiction anyway, right? I mean, here I am making my living working with a banjo player, right? That's fiction in my book. That's what's supposed to happen, you know?
Yeah, really.
So my life has been more fiction than reality. I figured I'd write the book about reality, but in a fictional way. And that way I felt that it would touch people even more.
You know, and again, you don't have to prove that, okay, look, man, putting this is taken from the book and let's, you know, you don't have to argue the fact that, hey, look, putting headphones on your knee and playing Amazing Grace will really help you. You know, you don't have to argue right. any of that. Wow, that's a really nice out. That's beautiful.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't want to believe it.
Sure.
And it's okay. I'm not trying to make you believe anything.
No.
It's okay if you don't. But those who do want to look further, or who even want to ask the question seriously to gain more information or to enter the world of possibility, not just to ask the question to argue, then I'll point you in directions. I literally run a camp called The Spirit of Music. And the people who have been to my camp called The Spirit of Music, they're reading a different book than the main public. You know, and there are things that are in this book just for them. Even when they read the word giraffe, a whole scenario is going to open up in their minds, you know. And then at that point, they're going to keep reading, and it's going to take what they learned at our camp further. And that's done on purpose. People who haven't been to that camp but who have been to other camps, they're going to read a slightly different book. But I also want the person who hasn't been to any of the camps realize that they're reading a different book also. But, you know, and there's a lot of things that play as fiction. Even, you know, putting headphones on a person's knee to help heal their knee.
Mm-hmm.
Go on YouTube. You'll see people waking up from comas because they hear music.
Yep.
You'll see videos of people who can't walk, but you put music on and they can dance down the hallway. Now you'll see people who are supposedly crippled and their hands can't even move until you sit them at a piano. You know, so music is this miraculous thing. I just put it in a story form.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Victor Wooten. Though we know of Wooten primarily as a bass player, he's an author as well, with his latest book being The Spirit of Music. He mentioned The Music Lesson as a song written out at the beginning of each chapter, or measure, as he calls them. This put together is the song behind us now. He spoke about that just a bit ago. We'll have more with Victor Wooten as KVC Arts continues. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I really, really hope people not just go out and pick up The Spirit of Music, but also The Music Lesson as well. But this might be a really good time to ask you to talk about the degradation of music. We were talking about those lengths, 12 inches, 8 inches, etc., because goes into the book so much. If you could talk about that analogy. There are a lot of beautiful analogies that I've picked up in the book or some of your speaking here and there, but I'd love to hear about this one.
Thank you. Yeah, this is in the opening chapter of the book, the opening measure that we call the prelude. I ended up cutting so much out of that because it was getting so long. I had so many different examples of how, you know, like we can eat food and you can fill your stomach, but it depends on the quality of the food that you're eating. It's to know whether you're healthy or not, or whether it's healthy. And so music's the same way. You know, I'm saying that music needs to be felt. And I know musicians are out there saying, hey, I can feel music. I listen to music every day. But I also wanted to bring up the thought that people probably aren't thinking about is that there is less and less music to be felt these days. And I don't mean that there are less songs, less radio stations. I don't mean that. I just mean there's literally, physically, less music to be felt. And the way I explain it, and I'll do it quickly here, if we think of listening to live music, going to a concert or listening to your buddy play or whatever, if we think about that as 12 inches, a foot, we may be able to think of listening to a vinyl record as 8 inches. Really, I would say live music would be more like 36 inches and vinyl 8 inches or something, you know. But I didn't make it that much of a difference, you know. But if we look at live music as 12 inches, vinyl maybe 8 inches, listening to a CD, which is made up of waveforms, now we're down to 6 inches, an MP3, which is a tenth the size of a waveform, which is what CDs are made of. So now an MP3, we're down to 0.6 inches, a half an inch. Now, put that half an inch through computer speakers or little headphones, we may be down to a quarter of an inch. And that's what our kids are growing up thinking is normal. So that's less music that's reaching us. That's like only eating unhealthy fast food, but thinking I'm eating more of it, so I should be, you know, I'm healthy. That's probably not the case. But again, that's only part of it. The fact that we're getting a quarter of an inch of music thinking it's normal, we're also not getting all the pitches. Because a lot of people have heard of the term pitch correction.
Yes.
And the current music that's on the radio is all pitch corrected. Any pitch that's a little bit off, we fix it. So we're only getting 12 of the tones. We're not getting all of the spectrum of pitches. There's a thing we call quantizing, which does the same thing as we do with pitches, fixing pitches, but we do it with rhythm. We quantize every mistaken rhythm or anything that's slightly off. We fix it. We quantize it. So we're not getting all the rhythms. Everything on the radio is also compressed.
Sure, yes.
Meaning
yes.
Anything that's soft, compression brings it up a little bit louder so you hear it all. Anything that might be too loud, we squash it so that it doesn't peak out the radio. But that's also why commercials are usually louder than the program that you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
Because a television show will have some dynamics. Someone might speak a little quietly and someone will shout. But the TV commercial is all shouting. So it sounds louder than the television because there's no peaks and valleys. So a lot of the music is that way. You don't hear much soft music on the radio anymore. So we've lost the dynamics. We've lost the pitches. We've lost, I should say, all the pitches. We don't have all the rhythms, and we're definitely not getting all the frequencies. Now, there's more to music than frequency, you know, pitch, dynamics. There's more. But how much do we have to lose before all of music dies, before all of music vanishes, the way a human does? The whole body doesn't have to get sick for the whole body to die. Just one part of the body has to get sick enough. And I do my best, David, not to say this is what's happening and it's bad. I try to raise questions. You know, if this is happening, what would we do about it if this is really what's happening? Now, the part that is really happening, there's less music. You know, we've gone from vinyl to CDs in my short lifetime.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, that's happening. I won't tell you that that's good or bad in the book. It may sound like it, and you can probably read between the lines and tell what I'm thinking. But I won't tell you that this is wrong or bad. But I will give you enough examples that you'll probably see that it might be wrong. You know, for example, I can buy a liter of Coke cheaper than I can buy an 8-ounce bottle of water.
Right.
And this is where the phasers come in. When we know that that's unhealthy, why do we make it easier to get, right? Why do we pay more for health? The healthier the food is, the more we have to pay. And we call it organic. It's just food.
Yep.
You know, we shouldn't have to label the natural stuff. I put it in different ways in that opening measure, in that opening chapter, so that you can see an example that relates to you, even if you're not a musician.
Yeah, absolutely. There are things, too, that I suppose everybody can relate to. It was a bit that struck me before I realized it was, quote, fiction. But then after realizing it was, again, quote, fiction, I accepted it as factual later. Now, what I'm talking about here is when your character is noticing tones and notes in everything. This is the irritating note of G from the alarm clock. Then even the C coming from the microwave, but then that ruins your appetite, that sort of thing. So I would think that this is from actual experience and, of course, maybe just truncated and combined for better story flow. But one that I really want to hear about, if it's true, because this is really wonderful conceptually. This is why I'm seizing on this one little thing here, and that is one of these two books. I want to say it's The Spirit of Music, but it could be either, and I think it maybe doesn't matter. But you have a conversation between a, quote, musician saying to your character that he was a musician, but you're a bass player. That moment of realization between those two few steps between four strings and whatever.
This is real cases. In music, we have a totem pole, and bass players are near the bottom in many cases. And it depends on what pole we're looking at, especially if we look at what I might call the music theory totem pole of what musicians are supposed to know. I should more accurately say what we think they know, right? We know that the horn player knows all the notes on the instrument. The piano player can read. We expect that. But we don't expect the bass player to know all the notes and what all the notes of the chord are. We don't tell the bass player, you know, that's the dominant chord or F sharp 11. You know, we don't say that. We just say it's an F. Yeah. And the singer, and I'm sad to say, especially if she's female, we don't expect her to know anything. And it's sad. It's prejudice. And it's not true. I moved to Nashville to work with a woman named Jonelle Mosser. I just mentioned in the first book about a woman named Jonelle called me to play. Well, that's why I'm in Nashville, is because of Jonelle. Now, you're in her band, and you play a chord, she'll say, no, that's not straight dominant. That should be the sus chord. I mean, she'll tell you. And she's a singer. And I'm like, whoa. You know, and when I joined her band, I didn't even know what the difference between regular dominant and sus. You know, so I'm like acting like I know. But I'm like, whoa, this woman knows her stuff. I got to sit up straight. But there's the totem pole. But then, I can't remember where in my life, maybe it dawned on me writing the book. It dawned on me, wait a minute, none of us should be playing instruments. When we talk, we don't say we're talking mouth, right? That's the instrument. We don't name the instrument. We're speaking a language. We're not speaking an instrument. So when we play, we should be playing music, not an instrument. In other words, your voice may be lower than mine, may be higher than yours, but I don't say, hey, I'm speaking soprano. It doesn't matter what the instrument you're speaking with. It's what you're speaking, what you're saying that matters.
Yeah.
And we listen beyond the instrument. In other words, I question whether Bob Dylan can really sing.
You're not on an isolated island there.
Right. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's not about his voice right now. It's about when his truth comes through, we'll listen to anything that he says.
Yeah.
Is Willie Nelson the best guitarist? Probably not. But if he plays a chord, one chord, that realness comes through, and we feel it and we listen. And music, when we play it, should be the same thing. So the real musician I don't know the better word than to say the real musician. And that sounds bad because it makes me say that everyone else is not real, but hopefully you understand what I mean.
Sure, sure.
The wise musician, the evolved musician, I don't have to come up with a better
nice way
word.
Of saying it.
I'll just stick with real. The real musician realizes it doesn't matter the instrument because that's not what I'm playing anyway. I'm playing music through an instrument. And I can't think of any musicians better than Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. And not to be egotistical and throw myself in there, but because I'm playing a bass, but a banjo, you hear all that music coming out of what we don't even think of as a real instrument in many cases, a banjo, and then Howard Levy on a regular diatonic harmonica, one that you used to be able to go to the store and pay $2.50 and get this instrument, and you blow through it, and it makes a nice chord. But all of a sudden, he's playing jazz like Charlie Parker or John Coltrane on this toy.
Oh, yeah.
And then you see my brother, Roy, Future Man, holding something that looks like from the Star Trek Enterprise.
Yes, indeed.
But you're hearing three drummers and two percussionists coming out of this thing. So you realize right away, wait, it's not the instrument. I told a person a story yesterday where I did a rehearsal with my brothers. And
oh, cool.
The rehearsal
cool.
was over in 2.5-3 hours. We're done. And I'm ready to leave when it hit me. Wait a minute. Roy just did that whole rehearsal as the drummer, and the whole time he just played a cardboard box. And this is not exaggeration. I didn't realize it. I had my bass strapped over my shoulder, my bag ready to go, and then it popped into my head. Wait a minute. A cardboard box. And the thing is, it didn't matter because all the music was there.
It's been conversation with Victor Wooten for the entirety of this edition of KVC Arts. While he is a very prolific bass player with many releases under his own name and being a founding and current member of Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, we spoke mainly about his books, The Music Lesson, and the very recently released The Spirit of Music. And while Victor sang that bit about the music was there all along, and that being such a nice way to wrap, tonight's show represents only about half of the conversation, which will continue on the next edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Victor Wooten and to James Meter of Vintage Books for getting me in touch with Wooten. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Sharina Wadd. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.